Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from Santa Clara University. My name is Kirk Hansen, Executive Director of the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, and your chair for this evening. The Commonwealth Club would also like to thank Santa Clara and the Women's High Tech Coalition for co-sponsoring this evening's program. It is my pleasure to introduce Karenna Gore Schiff, author of Lighting the Way, Nine Women Who Changed Modern America. Born and raised in Tennessee and Washington, D.C., politics have always been a strong part of Karenna's upbringing and still remains very close to her heart. Her grandfather, Albert Gore Sr., was a U.S. congressman and a senator, as was her father, Albert Gore Jr., who also served as Vice President of the United States. Karenna graduated from Harvard University with a bachelor's degree in history and literature and later received her law degree from Columbia University. During the 2000 and 2004 election, Karenna worked closely with her father as one of his most trusted political advisors and headed his youth outreach campaign. Her political background has always made her keenly aware and abreast of the issues that face our country: affordable child care, protecting the environment, providing our children with quality education are just a few of the issues that Karenna has passionately spoken for or written about in the last few years. Currently, Karenna works as Director of Community Affairs for the Association to Benefit Children. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Karenna Gore Schiff.
Thank you so much. I am really excited to be here in one of my favorite states, one of my favorite cities, and I want to thank you all for coming. Seems like it's a very centrist group, which is good news for a book that I feel is about nine women who could very much be described as progressives, but who I feel were making our country truer to its founding ideals in many ways. And I wanted to just speak briefly about why I wrote the book and the process of writing it, and then I will say just something brief about each of the women, read something brief from the introduction, and then we can begin our dialogue or discussion. So first, why I wrote the book. And there are really three reasons. The first is that ever since I was a young girl, I remember yearning for more female faces in the history books, for more heroines to choose from. And I recall looking at the charts of presidents on the walls and flipping through pages of generals and judges, and certainly some stellar female figures such as Eleanor Roosevelt and Rachel Carson, Rosa Parks, Jane Addams, all of whom I'm happy to say appear in force in Lighting the Way. But I always felt that there were probably more women doing interesting, consequential political things than were reflected there, than made it into the limelight, and I wanted to find their stories. The second reason that I wrote the book was to work through a little bit my feelings about politics, shall we say. I did, as was so thoughtfully mentioned, grow up around politics. One of my first memories was being on stage with my father when he won his first political race in 1976, and it was actually my third birthday, so the crowd sang to me, which I think is probably why I remember. I was a little shocked. But it's something that has always been very much a part of my life, and I've always had a somewhat sort of privileged vantage point on the campaign trail and rallies and conventions and nail-biting election nights. And after the 2000 election, I was feeling a bit disheartened, to put it mildly, maybe disillusioned, flirting with the cynicism that I think is quite pervasive, unfortunately, in our society and certainly among younger generations. But I really wanted to fight that, and I wanted to reject it and connect to what I always loved about politics, which was never the who's ahead in the horse race and who's scoring political points and the spin and the superficiality of it all, but really the real nitty-gritty of public service and of recognizing the human needs of our diverse population in this country and facing them and filling them with savvy and skill and ethical grounding. And that is certainly what all of these women did. And then there's a third reason that I wrote the book, and that is that I really wanted to celebrate and honor dissent in this country and really explore why it's so important that we not only tolerate minority viewpoints, but engage with them on the merits. Because I've always been intrigued by how we look back on someone in history raising a point about civil rights, equal rights, public health, environmental protection, and realize that although that person at the time was called unpatriotic, that that we look back and see that they were in fact right, clear, prescient. And certainly I think it's probably no accident that this occurred to me when suddenly I found that I was disagreeing with those in power on, you know, from the House and the Senate and the White House, the Supreme Court, and feeling like, why don't we celebrate dissent? That seems like a great idea. But anyway, those are the three reasons really that I wrote the book. And I did come away feeling so hopeful, so optimistic, and so much the richer for knowing these women and their stories. But the process of selecting them was difficult, challenging just to narrow it down, because what I did is I cast the net wide at first, and I really had a chance to delve into pockets of American history I've always found fascinating, whether it was yellow fever or coal mining or the history of Puerto Rico or the background of the suffrage movement, the drafting of New Deal legislation, the early recognition that AIDS was a major public health crisis. I was able to go down these roads and explore the background of these political issues in a way that I found fun. And heroines popped out all over the place. So I did find it challenging to narrow it down, and I ended up, I had the initial criteria going in came from my the reasons for writing the book. So I wanted to write about women who were not as well known, who were behind the major political movements of modern America, and who were not afraid to take unpopular stands. And then I ended up with a fourth criteria that helped me to narrow them down, and that was that I wanted them to have colorful, multifaceted personalities that personally appealed to me. So it did feel, I wanted it to be fun to write as well as to read, and it did feel at one point like I was organizing a dinner party. It was sort of how many is too many and who can't be next to each other, and I sort of worked through that, and 9 was never the magic number, but I did end up making several cuts, and I just couldn't possibly have cut anyone who was left with this 9, in this 9. So let me just say a word about each of them. Ida B. Wells Barnett is the first woman in the book, and she was born 6 months before the Emancipation Proclamation, a slave in the Deep South and in Mississippi. And she ended up bringing a very intelligent woman. Actually, just to give some context, her father was the son of his master during slavery, and she grew up knowing that, and she grew up knowing the searing and painful truths of race relations. And she became a journalist, and first she was a teacher, and then a journalist, a truth-telling journalist who was telling the most uncomfortable truths of her day. She brought one of the first legal challenges to segregation in 1883 when she refused to get off of a first-class train car for which she'd bought a ticket. She was asked to move to the Negro car, and she refused and was physically removed by the conductor with a crowd cheering. And he had to get several men to help him because she definitely fought back. And then she took legal action and had the expectation that it would be successful and she could take care of this in 1883, which is clearly intriguing and inspiring and also just a wrenching story where she was deeply disappointed. And she ended up focusing on lynching. And she became a major spokesperson who was documenting and exposing lynching, which, of course, was the extrajudicial and horrible torture and murder of black men, women, and children that was quite commonplace in the South. She, as one contemporary put it, shook this country like an earthquake with her exposés and had a huge effect and really changed the debate. That's Ida B. Wells Barnett. And then the next chapter is Mother Jones, one of the most colorful, fascinating women of American political history. And I think the most radical of the ones in the book, certainly over the top in some of her rhetoric. And incidentally, none of these women were perfect. And I sort of enjoyed painting pictures of them that showed their flaws and their weaknesses as well as their strengths. I think that it's a mistake to sort of put people on a pedestal. It makes politics seem more inaccessible in a way. But Mother Jones's story is fascinating. Just briefly, she came to this country from Ireland during the potato famine. She settled in Memphis. Her husband was an iron worker and a member of his local union. They had four children. And then a devastating thing happened, which was the yellow fever epidemic hit, and all four of her children and husband died. She got a permit to nurse the sufferers in the wake of this. And, of course, everyone who could leave during these epidemics, which swept the South every few years during that time, left. And those who remained were mainly blacks and poor whites. This had a searing effect on Mary Harris, as Mary Harris Jones, as her name, her given name was, given married name. And then she went to Chicago, where, believe it or not, she was actually wiped out by the Great Chicago Fire. She had set up a dress shop. So already this woman who's been through the potato famine and the yellow fever epidemic and the Great Chicago Fire has obviously been shaped by these things, all of which had socioeconomic realities surrounding them. And she then, in her later life, she did reinvent herself as this very fiery labor organizer who went in and organized coal miners at a time when they were living in company towns. No freedom of speech, paid in scrip, which basically meant they could only cash in what they were paid at the company store, which charged high prices and had them buy their own pickaxes and water for while they were working. And there was really no notion of workplace safety. And many, and these miners were quite powerless in the face of their employers, who were actually making huge profits at the time on in this business. And she went in, and she would just waltz right in. She didn't become famous until her 60s. She did her most high-profile work in her 80s, was jailed many times, and had a great flair for drama. And actually, it's hard to know how old she was exactly, because she padded her age. The only woman that I've ever heard of who consistently said she was much older than she was. And she had a great flair for drama. And really, although some of her rhetoric was quite shrill, when you look back at the context, at a time when it was not unusual for 10-year-olds to be working 12-hour shifts in mines and factories and be maimed or poisoned or even killed with no accountability, I think it's quite remarkable that she turned her life into a spotlight on that issue and really changed the national debate. So that's Mother Jones. And the next is Alice Hamilton. Alice Hamilton is one, and I should say that some of these women I hadn't heard of before I began this project. Some of them I had, and I just didn't know their full stories. Some I found in my initial research into these wider topics, and a few came to me through word of mouth, two of my favorites, and so I'll point them out in there in the middle of the book. But Alice Hamilton, I'll start by saying she was the first woman who was asked to join the Harvard faculty in 1919. And it wasn't because they wanted a woman. In fact, they did not want a woman. And they made two stipulations. They said, well, you can never participate in commencement, and you are not allowed to have any football tickets, which if you get to know Alice, you'll see how that devastated her. But they asked her because she was such a pioneer in her field, which was industrial medicine, meaning analyzing the effects of these chemicals on these new chemicals on the workers in the factories. And so she was early on discovering lead poisoning and mercury poisoning and really pushing in her own very genteel, collegial way for regulation of those chemicals, for protections to be in place for worker health and safety. And she really achieved a sea change in that concept. She worked actually in a way that would convince some captains of industries to make changes on their own, but then she also worked for changes in the law. When she joined Harvard, the Harvard faculty, she made a stipulation of her own, which was that she wanted to continue spending half the year at Hull House with Jane Addams. And she was a great friend to Jane Addams. She looked up to Jane Addams. And throughout her life, Alice Hamilton would then mentor many other women, including Eleanor Roosevelt, who wrote about what an impact Alice Hamilton had had on her. So quite remarkable woman. The next woman is Frances Perkins. And she I'd heard of as the first female cabinet secretary. Her story is so interesting and rich and colorful, and she was by no means a token woman in a cabinet, by no means condescended to by FDR, for whom she worked. She was actually a driving force behind much of the New Deal legislation, such as Social Security. And she had started out, actually, she also worked at Hull House, incidentally. I came away with just more awe than ever for Jane Addams and the impact that she had on American history. But Frances Perkins, initially, a turning point in her life was in 1911 when she was having tea with a friend in New York and the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire happened down the street. Horrible fire in a sweatshop where these young women had been locked in part to keep them working long hours in these very dangerous conditions, in part to keep labor organizers out. And they died, 300 some died, either inside or jumping out the windows onto the sidewalk. And Frances Perkins witnessed this firsthand. Her response, and she'd already been involved in advocacy and in some charity work, was to take legislators face-to-face with sweatshop workers to mount a full-scale campaign to have some regulation for having fire exits, for example, some safety, some accountability. And one of the legislators she took around was an assemblyman named Al Smith, who became the future reform governor of New York and later was famous as the first Catholic to run for president and quite a colorful, interesting character in and of himself, who I very much enjoyed getting to know. She worked for Al Smith, and he named her Industrial Commissioner of New York when he became governor, and then she worked for his successor, FDR, and went from there into the New Deal. The next woman is Virginia Durr. And Virginia Durr is one of my favorites because she's so funny and engaging and witty. And I just absolutely fell in love with her voice and her descriptions of the politics of her day. She was a passionate woman. She was an exuberant, gregarious hostess and socializer. A lot of the effect that she had was through her friendships and relationships. But she was born in a very racist family in Birmingham, Alabama, a white woman. And she was raised on tales of the gallant Confederacy and the inferiority of black people. And her own father was actually a registrar who bragged that no black person ever got past him at the polls. She, through a series of awakenings, as well as I think her own innate, very feisty sense of justice, came to be a firebrand on the vanguard of the civil rights movement. She fought the poll tax. She really built a coalition to abolish the poll tax in the mid-60s. And of course, this had been used to keep blacks from voting, as well as the kinds of questions and tests that people like Virginia's father would administer at the polls. And she successfully fought it. She also fought segregation, worked towards integration. She and her husband both did that and were remarkably effective and successful in doing so. And all the while, she wrote very funny, impassioned letters to her friends. She spent some time in Washington, but most of it in Alabama, first in Birmingham and then in Montgomery, where she moved after she was married. She also, incidentally, became very good friends with a seamstress named Rosa Parks. And Rosa did some freelance sewing in Montgomery, including for Virginia Durr. And actually, the two of them worked together when Rosa was the treasurer of the local NAACP. This was before she rose to fame, of course. And Virginia Durr actually encouraged Rosa to go to this integrated workshop in Tennessee, led by the next woman in the book, Septima Poinsett Clark. And Rosa Parks did so and experienced at Highlander Folk School, this integrated workshop that trained civic leaders, a real inspiration. She was already a very sophisticated political activist, but when she came back months after her time there under the leadership in a class of Septima Poinsett Clark, that was when she made her brave protest. And when she was thrown into jail after refusing to give up her seat to a white man, Virginia Durr was there with two other friends to bail her out of jail and was supportive throughout the boycott. The next woman is Septima Poinsett Clark, and she was born black woman in South Carolina. Her middle name, incidentally, comes from the fact that her father was born on the plantation of Joel Poinsett, who was a botanist and former ambassador to Mexico, who cultivated this flaming red flower and brought it over to the United States. She was a teacher, and she started these citizenship classes that, as I've explained, well, they went. The mission was literacy and voter registration and training civic leaders, and she was indeed quite effective. These classes eventually came under the auspices of Martin Luther King Jr.'s Southern Christian Leadership Council, and historian Taylor Branch has called them the payload of the civil rights movement. An incredible woman. Virginia and Septima were the two that I had not heard of. I hadn't heard of some of the others, but the two that were mentioned to me, word of mouth. And I really believe that their stories are sort of the heart of the book, and they knew each other and were friends. So the next woman is Dolores Huerta. Her history is probably quite familiar to many of you here because it was very much centered in California. Her legacy is, along with Cesar Chavez, organizing farm workers. And in many ways, I feel as if she picked up where Frances Perkins and Alice Hamilton left off. And actually, farm workers were not included in a lot of the New Deal legislation. They were sort of specifically carved out because the farm problem was seen as such a headache for the administration. And even though Frances Perkins had lobbied to have that sorted out and have the farm workers included, they didn't have the right to collective bargaining until Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez won that for them. And were facing, among her achievements, and she did it through really behind the scenes with Cesar Chavez being out front, but she did it through organizing strikes and boycotts and working very hard in grassroots ways. But she won the right to collective bargaining, and also everything from toilets and clean water provided to pension plans, and also fighting harmful pesticides, has already left a great legacy, is still, of course, alive and working today. The next woman is Helen Rodriguez Trias. She was a physician, moved back and forth from Puerto Rico to New York throughout her life. And really her main cause was to fight coerced sterilization, which was a terrible social policy, really, for some time, imposed on people of color, mainly Hispanics, blacks, Native Americans, and on the island of Puerto Rico. She was an early voice against that, a very collegial, very warm woman who built a lot of bridges within the women's movement and was also, incidentally, as a public health pioneer, one of the early voices recognizing AIDS as a scourge that should be on the center of the public health agenda. She said early on that it was a mistake that politicians were describing this as a disease that didn't affect the general population because, as she put it, it was not only cruel, but it blinded us to our own collective vulnerability. A great woman and public health and specifically women's health also pioneer. And then the last woman, and this was a real challenge for me, is it's somewhat of a departure because I know her and I've worked for her and she's a friend. So I think one of the reviews said, you know, unlike the other full portraits in the book, this reads more like a Valentine. So be it. And I do adore Gretchen. She's a child advocate. She works closely with Marion Wright Edelman on advocacy for things like Head Start and early childhood education for models for mental health treatment and housing that are very much suited to the challenges that we face on giving children born into poverty a real foothold in life. She combines that advocacy with hands-on programs, and so she herself provides care for families in Harlem, children and their families in Harlem, and also has made replicable models that have really made a national impact. So that's The Fine Woman. I'm just going to read briefly. I hope I haven't gone too far over my time. Should I take questions or read briefly? Okay. I'm going to read very briefly from the introduction. I'll start right here in the middle. Okay. All right. Gender is of the essence in these stories. For one thing, these women focused on human needs that were sidelined by those seeking to project a more masculine political agenda. Alice Hamilton explained that initially she felt a special responsibility to study the effects of chemicals on factory workers because qualified male scientists had rejected the field as tainted with socialism or with feminine sentimentality for the poor. This taint helps explain why so many issues, racial violence, the welfare of children, prejudice, illiteracy, public health, went unheeded by the establishment for so long. The genius of these individuals is that they not only addressed them, they made them part of the mainstream dialogue, effectively removing the taint and putting their causes on the political agenda. They all keenly understood and used the power of public awareness. Mother Jones's March of the Mill Children forced consumers to confront the suffering of the children who produced the goods they bought. More than 70 years later, Gretchen Buchenholz snuck a crew from 60 Minutes into one of New York City's squalid and treacherous welfare hotels to expose the plight of homeless children. They all believed in the importance of grassroots political movements, favoring a bottom-up approach to organizations and campaigns. While King was the national voice for civil rights, Septima Clark's citizenship schools provided what historian Taylor Branch calls the payload of the movement. While Cesar Chavez rose to international fame for leading the farm workers, Dolores Huerta organized the strikes and boycotts that gave them political leverage. They all wove webs of friendships and relationships that made their own attitude, in the words of George Eliot, incalculably diffusive. Virginia Durr, a gregarious hostess in her own home in Alabama, also wrote letters to her powerful friends in Washington, D.C., urging them to enforce federal civil rights laws. Helen Rodriguez-Triez recruited so many others to the campaign against coerced sterilization that one friend described her as the center of a wheel, with spokes coming out on all sides, helping it turn. Their experiences juggling work and family, a dilemma sometimes portrayed as unique to our time, were also a source of strength and imagination. The tales are harrowing. Dolores Huerta raised 11 children while organizing farm workers. Secretary of Labor Frances Perkins was responsible for both her teenage daughter and mentally ill husband. On the morning that President Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law, Perkins got a call informing her that her husband had escaped from a sanitarium. Helen Rodriguez-Triez gave birth to her fourth child in between graduating at the top of her class in medical school and establishing the first neonatal clinic on the island of Puerto Rico, in part because of their comfort with conflict and confusion. These women could see clearly above the fray and recognize opportunities to recalibrate social structures. As Septima Clark said, "I have a great belief in the fact that whenever there is chaos, it creates wonderful thinking. I consider chaos a gift." Often, I'm skipping two paragraphs, often their efforts were so solitary, so against the grain, that they must have felt the temptation to give in. Alice Hamilton was chastised by her Harvard colleagues for speaking out against the post-World War I Allied blockade that exacerbated the suffering and instability in Germany, but she refused to back down, lamenting the joyous ruthlessness around her. Virginia Durr, whose own internal transformation from a racist college student to a charismatic figure on the vanguard of the civil rights movement, provides a telescoped view of the awakening that much of the nation was going through, described her efforts to eradicate racism in Alabama in the 1950s as trying to sweep the sea back with a broom. It is humbling to think how often all of these women must have felt this way. As someone whose life of privilege has included an insider's vantage point on the sometimes imperfect electoral process, I was heartened to learn how much real political valor and power you cannot see from there. These individuals had the extraordinary vision and courage to combat injustice, and our country is the better for it. Here are 9 stories of women who were not afraid to give up the ground in the crowd Rilke spoke of, and, in Virginia Durr's words, step outside the magic circle. With perseverance and compassion, they lived full bore in the service of others and of truth, lighting the way.
Thank you, Corinna. And for the listening audience out there, you've been listening to Corinna Gore-Schiff. She's the author of Lighting the Way, 9 Women Who Changed Modern America. Good evening. My name is Isabel Duran. I'm the anchor of Cron 4 Weekend Morning News in San Francisco, and I'll be moderating tonight's question and answer session. You gave us a lovely primer on a very big book. And you sort of took the steam out of my first question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I need to ask anyway. You talked about writing about people who really made politics about public service. But why, and I'd heard the answer, but I still want to know again, why did you choose to spotlight only women? Was it so tough to find a guy out there?
I chose to spotlight only women because of that feeling that I had that there were more women than were celebrated in the historical pantheon. And I really do think that we have a bit of catching up to do on that. I think that it's not that women are suddenly in positions of political power and leadership. I think that they always have been. But that it's just often been behind the scenes. And I really wanted to explore that. And I also wanted to explore how the bias towards male leadership had also enabled them or caused them to be more creative, unconventional, and inventive in how they went about political change. But I have to say, I also discovered some unsung heroes in the process. And Miles Horton, Fred Ross, to some extent, Al Smith, were all men that I came away feeling deserved accolades themselves. So there are a lot of great men in the book too.
I was interested in the dinner table concept and the fact that you said there were some you would not put next to each other. I'm curious to know why. You talked about dissent, so even dissent sometimes can't rub up against itself.
Well, I think that's a very good question. In some ways, I like to juxtapose personal styles and approaches, and that the personal style issue, it doesn't always correspond. Doesn't correspond at all, actually, in my opinion, with background and circumstance. Septima Clark and Alice Hamilton, in many ways, were the most alike in terms of how they approached their challenges and couldn't have been more different in their backgrounds. But I think I was also sort of considering I didn't want to be too repetitive in what I was talking about because I wanted to set the scene and the context. I didn't write about, for instance, Mary McLeod Bethune, who is an extraordinary woman, because I felt that her story was encroaching on Septima Clark and Virginia Durr and was better told through their stories. And I solved this a little bit with footnotes in terms of the women that I wasn't able to write about. And the footnotes are a little self-indulgent, so don't, you know, if you're not interested in one, don't read them. But I enjoyed being able to sort of add a little bit of context through them. But there's certainly those of these women that I feel would get along and those that I think would not, so.
Is there someone, you talked about Virginia Durr, you seem to like her quite a bit. Is there someone, though, that you identified with the most who reflect some of your own personality?
Well, I think it's hard to judge, I feel these women I look up to so much, so it's hard to say, it's hard for me to put myself in full connection with one of them. But the thing that I loved about Virginia was that she was so funny and she had so much fun and she was really interested in people, and she didn't mind disagreeing with people, and she was very intrigued by political differences, and she would she loved being a hostess and having dinner parties and sort of mixing it up, and she was she really enjoyed life. She had a wonderful, loving relationship to her husband, and so I really relate. I relate to her in the sense that, I mean, I think that the temperament of Ida B. Wells or Mother Jones, frankly, would be more difficult to cope with. But I find that someone like Virginia is very appealing to me for that reason. And she also has my same birthday, which I thought was kind of cool.
It's the small things, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, readers of your book say they were inspired by the women you wrote about because despite tremendous odds they faced, you showed them triumphant. These women you write about are largely unheralded, you said, and Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote that these compelling portraits of women who helped bring about a quiet revolution in the American way of life. Is that what's really needed in today's politics of seeming bombast and bluster, that which you came to dislike?
Quiet revolution. That's interesting. I think that yes. I think that it's very heartening to me and inspiring to me to see how these women rejected bitterness and hatred and really instead did very substantive things every day in their own lives. And they rejected despair as well. And so I think when you look at Septima Clark, for instance, and she was thrown in jail, a woman in her 60s who was basically a teacher who was trying to erase racism. And the fact that she was able to sort of look and see that the powers that were in her day were all standing against her and yet teach one student at a time and with equal respect and compassion and attention to each of them, just make her own way in the world. And she talked about kind providence guiding her. And incidentally, she also she led a campaign for the hiring of black teachers. Early on, there weren't even black teachers in black schools hired in Charleston, and she led a campaign for that, and then later a campaign for equal pay for black teachers working with a young lawyer named Thurgood Marshall, who became the legendary Supreme Court justice also. But the fact that she did that, and then one of her students was John Lewis, who's serving his 10th term as congressman from Georgia and was a civil rights leader. Another student happened to be Rosa Parks. And you just see how that way of moving through life, I think, is so graceful and effective.
Let's flash forward to today's women leaders. Women leaders that you might talk about, are they necessarily inside the political arena, or are you seeing some outside that arena that you admire who are more like the women in your book?
Well, I think both. I mean, I think it's great that women are in elected office in larger numbers as well, and certainly that seems to me a natural progression because I do feel that women have been political leaders, as I've mentioned all along. I think there are some I see that are more outside of elected office. Marion Wright Edelman is certainly one who is consistently a voice for vulnerable children born into poverty in this country and really an advocate. Certainly there are others. Dorchen Lighthold is someone who is working with immigrants, particularly women, is on the cutting edge and has been for some time in combating domestic violence, which is a very serious problem, which is often sort of swept under the rug or not described with the dynamics that need to be understood. And she's somebody who, for instance, when there's a recent immigration bill that would criminalize providing social services to illegal immigrants, was pointing out exactly who that would hurt, which includes, of course, women who are maybe internet brides or have been sent over here at age 15 or West African and obviously also potentially productive, patriotic American citizens who we should respect. So she's another one. Susan Solomon, who's a scientist and an advocate on global environmental issues. There are many outside. And then, of course, there are those inside the political process as well.
So there's another book in the making.
There certainly could be, and it could from any number of people other than me, too. So.
Well, as we know, politics is never an easy bedfellow on whichever side of the political spectrum one sleeps, so to speak. Many adults, and it appears even younger people, have written off the electoral process. You, of course, out on the campaign trail trying to invigorate the young camp, the youth vote. Also because of a disillusionment, their heartfelt belief that somehow politics and politicians do not work in their best interest. You talked about after 2000, you were dismayed. Did you take a vacation from politics while you wrote the book, and did the book, I think you did say, help you recommit, but in what way?
Interesting question. I did sort of... I don't think that I ever had a vacation, but I chose to practice law, and I practiced copyright, intellectual property, mainly copyright law, and that to me was a very kind of safe place to be in the initial aftermath when I was feeling so emotionally involved in every single thing that I would read in the paper, and I think that was probably. For the best at that point. But I then, through working for Gretchen at the Association to Benefit Children, I came back to sort of where the rubber meets the road. So it was seeing these children come in, and their families are homeless, and their mothers are single mothers in many cases, trying to work to earn money for clothes and food, and they had no... great daycare option, an early childhood option, and Gretchen is there providing that. And if we don't get funding from Head Start, it will be much more difficult to do so. And that just sort of, to me, is just connecting to the source again about what we mean when we mean politics. And it doesn't mean, what people are shouting about necessarily on the Sunday morning shows. But it certainly, to me, feels like what I'm more passionate about. But remind me, am I answering? Is that... what was the last part of that question?
And she's young, too. Happens to the best of us. Well, see, and I was listening about something else because of what you said. You had written an article in 2001 in Glamour in which you were criticizing the Bush administration, and the conservative critics came back and blasted you and said that, well, of course, you're just like your pops. You want to have the government pay for everything and create all of these social programs. Are you just like your father?
I admire my father a great deal and would always be honored to be compared to him. I think, we're two individuals and certainly are different by virtue of our personalities and our experiences. But, I've noticed that there seems to be this kind of knee-jerk personal attack response on the part of the right towards raising these issues. And so, I mean, I saw that recently even when, happened to be my United States senator from New York, Hillary Clinton, raising a point about the priorities in the budget recently and saying that the cutting of first response funding, as well as the cutting from Head Start and other programs, which in order to make permanent the tax cuts, which largely went to the wealthy. And the immediate thing was, oh, how angry she is. And, I just think that that's exactly the kind of thing that turns people off from politics. It would just be so much more helpful if you disagree on the merits to discuss it on the merits. And I find that unfortunately it doesn't happen enough. So that's my answer.
Well, then I can follow right in. Tori Clark, she's the former Pentagon spokesperson who became quite the celebrity during the Iraq War, writes in her book that Americans are tired of spin. She suggests simply telling the truth might be the perfect approach, but that gets us back to, but whose truth? From which side is it coming, and therefore how is it interpreted, and therefore can you dialogue?
I think that there's sort of... I mean, first of all, I certainly agree that the truth should be told, and I think that we should be very vigilant about seeing how deeds relate to words, how actions and steps taken follow rhetoric. And that's what I would take that to mean. So politically speaking, I think that, and certainly all the women in this book, back to Ida B. Wells, who was so vigilant, and they were all these women paid very careful attention to language, actually, which I found to be a very interesting theme. So when Ida B. Wells would read something about a black harlot in the newspaper, she'd pick up her pen and write a letter to the editor saying that that sort of casual slander is unacceptable. And that was true with Virginia Durr. It's very, very interesting. She pointed out that the word improvident was being used a lot in her time to describe poor people, including she was remembering how she would see, and her story is also about just recognizing horrible poverty as well as the racism. And she would see these children, white and black, shaking from rickets, from not having enough calcium. And a lot of these children ended up being crippled or dying as a result. And her parents would say, oh, they're just like that. You know, they're improvident, meaning their families hadn't provided for them, and if you try to help them, they'll just go buy liquor or whatever. And you know, that was another word that was used, and that's all spin. It's always been with us, and I think that the genius of these women, and again, I mentioned in the talk earlier about AIDS doesn't affect the general population. You know, these are all code words, and it's all spin, and I think that in order to fight it and tell the truth, what we need to do is what these women did, which was not be afraid to question those in power, and you can do so respectfully, but also to shine light where things are being hidden. And so I certainly think that's called for now.
So what is your perception of today's media coverage of Washington, D.C., the war?
Well,
I guess that's a tough one.
I was absolutely stunned in the lead up to the war, and certainly I think it influenced my deep desire to write about those who were in dissent in their day. That people who raised questions, not just about, and this was after 9/11, and as one of those raising questions about the course that the country took, and one who, you know, had been with my two young children, one 3 week old, in Manhattan, the fact that those raising these questions were called unpatriotic or soft on terrorism was just deeply offensive. And I think that looking back, I mean, raising questions not just about whether to go to war, but how to go to war, were sort of pushed aside or shut up or called unpatriotic or told they didn't know what they were talking about. And the country is much worse off because of that. And I think that very much influenced me. And I was so disappointed that most in the media seemed to sort of go along hook, line, and sinker. So, I did find that was pretty bad. And I think that in a way I do take great comfort in the past, because I can look back and see that with what these women were up against, and what they faced was just such inner conviction and fortitude, was a popular press in their day that was not always, shining light on the right things, was often going along with whatever the sort of line of those in power was at the time, and yet they made a difference, and they worked every day, and their individual actions actually changed the headlines and changed the public perception. And sometimes it sort of can come with breakthroughs when you least expect it. So I'm hopeful about that.
Speaking of change or of having impact on what is going on. You've been quoted as saying, sometime in my life, I might want to run for elective office, but I'm conflicted about what goes into it. Tell us about that.
Mm. Well, I don't know that and again, that's something that I feel like could come later on if it comes at all for me. And I think one thing that I loved and found inspiring about the stories in Lighting the Way was that a lot of these women made their strongest marks in their 60s and in some cases beyond. So I think being on the longevity plan is a good thing. But I think in terms of what goes into it, first of all, the raising money, I mean, that was always sort of my dad's least favorite thing, and it does take a lot of time, and it's really too bad. I wish we could sort of solve that, because I think that keeps a lot of people away from running for office. And then the other thing is just obviously the kind of your private life and personality can get so mangled, which is not very appealing. So I think that those are probably the two main things. But not only for me, for so many people, for so many in younger generations, and I'm sure older generations too, who just sort of think, well, I would never do that, and which is really too bad because it is so crucial that we have good people in elective office. So perhaps through reform and a little bit of sort of more open-mindedness in the media and more focus on substantive issues, that can change.
You, one of the things that you'd mentioned in the book about these women's lives was that it impacted their children's lives and not always to the best. You were also talked about concern for your own children, being there for them, having yourself being the daughter of a politician and his absence. So does that also impact perhaps your decision about whether the political trail is the one you want to follow?
Well, I would say, I mean, first of all, I felt very much parented by both of my parents. So, and I also really relate to, and again, I would go back to also the fact that we live in such a youth-oriented culture, and particularly with women, I think, who are concerned about how much time they're spending with their career or with their kids, and I think it's not just this narrow sliver of our lives that are going to make or break us. So, you know, there are going to be years when my children are older, and I think many women face that kind of arc in their life. But I think that that certainly it can be a very demanding schedule, and for my father, who worked incredibly hard and still does actually out of office, I certainly would not be prepared for that kind of schedule right now. But then there are others that take a different approach to that job. So, but in any event, I feel very fortunate that my parents were very present for me and thankful.
Are they present today?
I think my mom is here. I think she slipped in. So, hi, Mom. Thank you.
Tipper Gore is with us, and we are speaking to Corinna Gore Schiff and her book, Lighting the Way, Nine Women Who Changed.
And I would have said that if she weren't here, too.
Very good. Well trained. Representative Harold Ford of Tennessee said, he remembered you since forever. So he calls you strong-willed and tough, more like your paternal grandmother. That was Pauline Gore, who was the first woman to graduate from Vanderbilt Law School in Nashville. And then from Claire Shipman, who followed your father's campaign, she says of you, she's not only got a great political sense, but a real fighter's instinct, and was the one who was always pushing your father to move on.
So where'd you find all this stuff? This is very nice.
Well, I suppose you would say those are great attributes for the campaign trail, but don't necessarily speak to a kinder, gentler political process. How do you be what it's necessary to be to win without losing your personal integrity in the process in this day and age?
Well, I mean, I guess that I think winning an election, although it's so incredibly important, sometimes it's important to also be able to lose for the right reasons. And I certainly grew up thinking that my grandfather lost his Senate seat in 1970 for the right reasons. He was very fiercely challenged, called the target number one by the Nixon White House because he was against the Vietnam War and he was progressive on civil rights. And I think that, I mean, I definitely subscribe to the theory of political leadership that there is something about sort of inner conviction that we want in our leaders and not just following public opinion polls. So I don't know. And then I think being tough is probably necessary in that world as well.
beyond simply criticizing the policies of current administration, what should the progressive Democratic movement be saying about the future of America, and who among the current Democratic leaders is saying it?
Well, actually, I mean, I think that a lot of the current Democratic leaders are saying very important and interesting things, and sometimes it's just very hard for them to break through. So, I mean, I have seen great speeches from both my senators in New York, Senators Schumer and Clinton. I've seen I'm a fan of my Attorney General Eliot Spitzer, currently running for governor, and across the country, Senators Boxer and Feinstein certainly have said important things. Have not only questioned the priorities and approaches of this administration, but have also laid out alternative approaches. I think it's really hard when the hands of the government are so solidly in one party. I mean, where you have the House and the Senate and the White House all in one party's hands, because oversight hearings aren't as tough. Questions raised. I mean, the agenda on the Senate floor and the House floor is set by the same party that's being led by the White House, and so. Although I completely understand that we need to not just sort of point and blame Republicans, I think that that's the reality, and it is important to shift a little bit of balance of power there. I'm very proud of my father. He's made some extremely forceful, well-thought-out speeches about where we're going in terms of environmental policy, about the policy of wiretapping without a warrant, and outside of the law and the dangers raised by that, and I believe that he's speaking now not from one party or the other, but as somebody who just cares deeply about our country. But I think many people are, and I think hopefully there can be the kind of rigorous debate where we focus on those substantive points being raised by those public servants.
We are at our last question. You've mentioned her a couple of times now, your senator from New York, Hillary Clinton. You talked about her being called angry, which some of her supporters say is just another way to demonize her. What do you think her chances are running for president? Are you going to support her campaign?
Well, you know, I'm not just being coy when I say she is running for re-election to the Senate, and I'm very much aware of that because it's a active campaign in New York right now for 2006, but obviously not with a lot of opposition. So it's way too early. It's barely 2006, and I think there are a lot of strong Democrats and potential candidates out there, and I wouldn't. I would support most likely whoever the nominee would be, and I don't know right now, but I do think that she's doing a good job, and I certainly admire her her perseverance and her intelligence.
And if they offered you a job on the campaign trail, would you go?
I don't know. That would depend on a lot of things, including whether or not I can get my four-year-old to sleep in her own bed all night, and other things like that.
The more important problems that you have to do.
And if I sort of get, I mean, I love the process of writing the book, to be honest, too, and I'd love to write another book. I had a lot of fun writing this one, and it was a very gratifying process, so I may do that.
Thank you very much, Karenna.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate you being here.
I hope you have all enjoyed this evening's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Karenna Gore-Schiff, author of Lighting the Way, 9 Women Who Changed Modern America, and Isabel Duran, weekend anchor of KRON 4 Weekend Morning News, and Santa Clara University and the Women's High Tech Coalition for co-sponsoring this evening's program. We'd like to thank you, our audience here in Santa Clara, and those who have joined us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, part of the nation's largest and oldest public affairs forum, is adjourned.